As I said, we're kicking off the programme with a chat with our new-ish director of Luxman Ireland House, Professor Kevin Kenny. Enjoy that, folks, and we'll go from Kevin to Finn. I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life someone who I'm slightly embarrassed to say now that he's here a few months, director of Luxman Ireland House, Professor Kevin Kenny. Welcome to the programme, Kevin. I'm sorry, I should have had you on before now.
No, thank you, Miriam. I'm delighted to be on the programme today.
And I'm delighted to take this opportunity with you to draw attention to our wonderful collaboration with Carnegie Hall and the Migrations Festival, which is taking place currently and over the next few weeks. And I suppose, in general, what we'll do is set up a little bit and whet people's appetite in terms of your talk, which takes place on Friday, April 12th, and it's about the Paxton Boys of Pennsylvania. Could I start off by asking you, Kevin, a little bit for people uninitiated, how significant was the migration from Ulster to the United States in the early 18th century? And maybe you could lay out a bit of the context for the Paxton Boys.
Yeah, so this is a story set in the middle of the 18th century, 1763. And if we stop the clock around then and ask who were the American Irish and where did they live, the answer is kind of surprising, because we typically start the story of Irish-American history with the famine in the 19th century, but the American Irish in the 18th century were mainly Presbyterians from Ulster, and there was very heavy emigration in the 18th century, comparable to what we see in the 19th century, but involving a different kind of Irish person. They settled mostly in Pennsylvania, and then after settling in Pennsylvania, they moved to the south. It's an interesting question. What should we call the Irish of the 18th century? Today we call them Scotch-Irish or Scots-Irish. There's some dispute as to which term is better. In the 18th century, we see that term used sometimes, but mostly they were just called the Irish because they were the Irish of the 18th century. Sometimes they were identified as Ulster Presbyterians, Presbyterians, or dissenters, dissenters from the established Church of England. So many names, in fact, that one historian has called them the people with no name.
Wow. I purposely didn't, Kevin. I wasn't sure which term is more accurate, Scots-Irish and Scotch-Irish, and we use one term on one side of the Atlantic more often than another here. Is that right? Or is that my perception?
I think that's right. The term Scots-Irish, I think, is probably more commonly used in Ireland, or it might simply be Ulster Scots, mm-hmm. which is another variation because they were of Scottish descent, most of them. Some people prefer to use the term Scotch for whiskey. Some people think that's just snobbery and call them Scotch-Irish. Mm-hmm. So the point is there's multiple names, and that's kind of what makes them interesting. These people who migrated from Ireland in large numbers in the 18th century were themselves only a couple of generations removed from parents and grandparents who had migrated from Scotland to Ulster. And then the migration takes place from Ulster to Pennsylvania, and then from Pennsylvania down through the southern backcountry, through Maryland and Virginia, through the Carolinas, all the way down to Georgia. So it's a story of remarkable mobility. And I think what's driving the migration in all cases, whether from Scotland to Ireland, whether from Ireland to Pennsylvania or Pennsylvania to the south, is two things. One is a desire for land that they could call their own, and the other is a desire for some version of religious freedom where they could practice their Presbyterian faith as they saw fit.
So did you, Kevin, was your interest in that period and that migration, was that an interesting kind of starting early on chronologically in terms of the Irish experience in America?
Yeah, so some years ago I wrote a book called The American Irish, And the first thing I asked is, who counts? Who counts as Irish and who counts as American Irish? And the answer I gave was broad and ecumenical, which is anybody born on the island of Ireland is part of Irish history, regardless of religious or political affiliation. And any of them who moved to America are part of the story of the American Irish. So as I said, if you were to stop the clock in 1763 and ask who were the American Irish and where did they live, you'd find that three-quarters of them were Presbyterians from Ulster. Are they Irish? Well, yes. Give me a reason why they wouldn't be part of Irish history. Are they part of the story of the American Irish? Yes, even though that story is best known from the period of the Great Famine onwards, they were the Irish of the 18th century. They weren't the same as the Catholic Irish who came later, obviously, but they were migrants from that one island to this part of the world.
Do you have a sense, based on your research, Kevin, and with the understanding that of how terms can change and are subject to responding to change over time, would they have shuddered or shivered at being called Irish at that time?
I don't think they would in the 18th century, but they would in the 19th century. Now, that's a very clear answer to a very good question, because in the 18th century, when three-quarters of the Irish migrants were Protestants, when they were the dominant group, there was no need for them to mark themselves off as different from other Irish people. So the term Scotch-Irish or Scots-Irish, whichever you prefer to use, comes into currency in the United States from about the 1830s onwards. Why? Because from that time forward, the majority of immigrants from Ireland to America are Catholics. So these people of Ulster Presbyterian origin appropriate the term Scots-Irish and apply it to themselves as a badge of pride to distinguish themselves from the Catholic Irish who are coming in. And I say badge of pride because to the extent that the term is used in the 18th century, Scots-Irish, it's often a pejorative term, a critical term. There are references to the Wild Irish in the 18th century, but the Wild Irish are the Ulster Irish in the 18th century.
Wow.
So it's not uncommon in American immigration history to appropriate a term like that. Chicano is another example, where you take a term ostensibly of abuse and you say, well, wait a second, that's our term, that's our heritage, and that's what we're going to call ourselves.
Fascinating. So in your talk on the Paxton Boys, you're looking at a particular moment that has a significant effect, as you will argue, I believe, on that era in American history as well, and American society more generally, and the political culture of colonial America. Can you, without giving too much away in advance, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about the Paxton Boys specifically?
Sure, no spoilers, just a few. So one of the striking characteristics of the Scots-Irish, I'll use that term now, or the Ulster Presbyterian Irish, when they come to colonial America, is that they move west in large numbers. They move to what we would call the frontier, and indeed what they call the frontier. That term, the frontier, is in the sources. It's the term that was used in the 18th century. And they move there for the reason I mentioned earlier, is they want land, and they want freedom to practice their Presbyterian faith as they see fit. So although in Pennsylvania maybe half of the Ulster Irish remain in the eastern portion of the state around Philadelphia, engaging in all sorts of economic and political pursuits, the other half move west. And what happens when they move west to the frontier is that they live next to Native Americans,
mm-hmm.
and they come into conflict with Native Americans. They're eager to get their hands on land. They will set up as squatters on land, land that is owned by the Penn family, in Pennsylvania, but that is claimed by Native Americans. So both the Penn family and the Native Americans have a stake in the land. Scots-Irish settlers and squatters will go onto that land and claim it by tomahawk right. In other words, they will take an axe or a tomahawk, they'll carve their initials in a tree, they'll walk 200 yards east or west and carve their initials in another tree, demarcate that territory and say, this is ours, this is mine, right? So I want to be sure to clarify that by no means all of the Scots-Irish are frontiersmen who engage in squatting and conflict with Indians of this kind. But I also want to say that significant numbers of them do.
Mm-hmm.
There's an intriguing parallel there between what the Ulster Irish are doing on the frontier and their lives in Ulster itself, because in Ulster they often served as a buffer between an Anglican elite and a lower class perceived as barbaric, which in that case was the dispossessed Catholic population in Ulster. When you cross the Atlantic, you see them occupying a similar buffer zone between Eastern elites and the perceived savage, in this case being the Native American. So they're on the frontier, and when conflict breaks out, they are the first line of attack. They are the first to be attacked. They're the first line of defense, but they're the first to be attacked by Native Americans. And this reaches a peak during the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. known in Europe as the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War from 1756 to 63, followed by the greatest uprising in American Indian history up to that point, Pontiac's Rebellion. Right. So it's in this context, if we narrow it down, that the story of the Paxton Boys arises. So,
well, it's fascinating in terms of the positioning the similar role on both sides of the Atlantic.
It is broadly similar, yeah. And broadly combative. And again, it's a role that some Ulster Irish fill by no means all, but it is happening in the frontier. So if we kind of zoom in now and narrow the focus within that broad context that we've been discussing, and we look at what happens in Pennsylvania in the 18th century. Well, the colony had been set up by William Penn in 1692. As a holy experiment of what he called a peaceable kingdom on Quaker principles, which among other things are pacifist, mm-hmm. which means that Pennsylvania did not have a militia, and on principles of, I think, uncommon decency and understanding toward Native Americans. So Penn was interested in Native American languages and cultures. He also purchased the land in the colony from the Native Americans who claimed title to the land. Now, their sense of title was very different. The Native Americans didn't believe that land could be owned by an individual who was held in a tribal trust.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't believe that an individual could buy or sell it. William Penn needed legal title to land in order to acquire the land, sell it, and pay off his debts. Right, so that's the context we're working in. So Penn sets up his peaceable kingdom, his holy experiment. It can't really work for the reason I've just mentioned, which is the conflict over title to land. What does it mean to own land? Mm-hmm. European and Native American conceptions are radically different. But what little chance it had of working comes to an end really with the arrival of the migrants from Ulster, because they arrive in Philadelphia, half of them go west, they squat on the land, they disregard the title of both sides, and they say, we want this, this is ours. Now, as a result, you get Scots-Irish settlements, which in those days, they're not much further west than the Susquehanna River, which is 100 miles west of Philadelphia, around where Lancaster is today.
Okay.
That's the frontier. When war breaks out, the Ulster Irish settlements are the first to be attacked. but there's nobody to defend them because this is a Quaker colony without a militia. So they're furious. So the Paxton boys decide in the end to take the law into their own hands. Living near them, maybe 40 miles downriver from Paxton, which, by the way, is today's Harrisburg. Mm. It was a ferry across the Susquehanna River, today's Harrisburg. About 40 miles downriver is a peaceful Indian settlement inhabited by the Conestoga Indians. They've been there since the 1690s. William Penn set aside, I think, about 500 acres for them. And actually, they maintain an allegiance with the Penn family. They're peaceful. They're not Christian. We don't know that much about them. And they're living in Conestoga Indian Town. Well, the Paxton boys emerge out of kind of ad hoc rudimentary militia companies who are fighting in the French and Indian War and Pontiac's Rebellion. And they descend on Conestoga Indian Town in December 1763. There are only 20 Indians left at that point. And that morning, only six of them are actually present. The rest are out around the countryside. They make brooms and baskets, which they sell to sustain a living. They slaughter the six of them. The remaining 14 are put in Lancaster workhouse and jail for their protection. 2 weeks later, the Paxton boys ride into town, break open the workhouse, and kill the remaining 14. So these are the notorious Conestoga massacres of 1763, December 1763. The last of the Conestoga Indians are killed. It's a deeply symbolic action. The Paxton boys ride into town in broad daylight. They repudiate the peaceable kingdom and what's left of it. And they proclaim, in effect, that there is no such thing as a friendly Indian, that all Indians are enemies and are fair game. Now, the story might have ended there, but about a month later, in February 1764, reports reach Philadelphia that the Paxton boys are marching on the city, several hundred of them, perhaps more, threatening to sack the city if their demands are not met. Now, Philadelphia is defenseless because the Quakers are pacifists. Some of the Quakers take up arms, and that is perceived as rank hypocrisy by the Paxton boys. They wouldn't fight on our behalf, now they're taking up arms to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. But what happens in the end is the city sends out a delegation led by Benjamin Franklin to a place called Germantown, which is just on the outskirts of the city. Mm-hmm. It's about 6 miles north. Mm-hmm. And Franklin meets the Paxton boys in Germantown, and he persuades them to write down their grievances. And they produce two pamphlets, two declarations, really, of the grievances of the backcountry against metropolitan Philadelphia. And what follows is a war of words rather than a war of weapons. In other words, it sets Philadelphia aflame politically, and there's an exchange of over 60 pamphlets and some of the first political cartoons in American history where the various factions, pro and anti-Paxton boy, Presbyterian, Quaker, Anglican, have at each other in a way that really distills the essence of politics and religion in colonial Pennsylvania.
But no deaths or violence in Philadelphia.
No deaths or violence in Philadelphia. There were Indians there in protective custody. The Paxton boys wanted to inspect them, but given what they had done in December, that it's not hard to imagine what that inspection might have led to. So it's a peaceful outcome. Mm-hmm. In Philadelphia. However, the long-term consequences are grim. Because nobody was ever prosecuted, arrested, brought to trial, or convicted for the Conestoga massacres. And that is a terrible precedent to set, because it really validates the Paxton boys' position that there's no such thing as a friendly Indian or a good Indian, and it marks the declaration of open season on Indians in Pennsylvania. So what happens over the next 10 years is wave after wave of similar acts of violence, some perpetrated by Scots-Irish, some not, against the Indians on the frontier. Now, there's an ironic outcome to the story, because in 1764, Benjamin Franklin is so upset at the Presbyterian supporters of the Paxton Boys, and really at his wit's end about what to do, that he proposes that the colony of Pennsylvania, which is still owned by the Penn family, it's what's known as a proprietary colony, he proposes that it be placed under royal government, directly under royal government. Now, that's very ironic when we think of Benjamin Franklin, who only 11 years later will be coming back to America to abolish royal government for the colonies as a whole. So it's a strategic move, and it backfires because he loses his seat in the election and actually moves to England for that 11-year period. But there's a further irony. Benjamin Franklin was the most vocal critic of the Paxton Boys in 1764, and yet he and the Paxton Boys end up fighting more or less on the same side in the Revolution. And the reason for that is there's more than one revolution. There's the Metropolitan Revolution that we're familiar with in Boston and Philadelphia. That's the received narrative of the Revolution. But there's something else going on in the West on the frontier, and that involves fighting Indians as an act of patriotism, just possessing them, taking their land. And the two sides come together as the twin arms, if you like, of the Revolution. The Revolution was very bad news for Native Americans. They were more afraid of the Americans than they were of the British.
Wow. And the reverberations of all this are so impactful, really, when we think about it.
They are, and there's a sadness, of course, when it involves Native American history. And here, of course, we're going well beyond the Scots-Irish case that I've been talking about. But, you know, there are in the United States today, I think last I looked, about 550 tribes and nations that have federal or state recognition. None of them are in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
We don't think of Pennsylvania when it comes to Native American history.
Sure.
But the one reason is that the story that unfolded in the American West, which is kind of similar to the one I'm telling here, just happened earlier in Pennsylvania, and the traces are no longer there.
Wow. I want to remind people and actually mention the fact that Kevin's talk on the Paxton Boys is going to be part of a two-day symposium called From Migration to Music, Scotch-Irish Contributions to America, and it's being held here at Luxman Ireland House. We're thrilled to not only collaborate with Carnegie Hall and the Migrations Festival, the Making of America program, but also with our friends at the Scotch-Irish Society of the United States of America on pulling these strands together and having this conversation about this early period in Irish migration to the United States. Kevin, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat to me here on this Irish American life. And for anyone who wants to hear more, and I know it will be very interesting to hear, Kevin. I know you've given us a good summary there, but there'll be more, I'm sure, in his talk on Friday, April 12th. And following on from our conversation with Adrian last week from Carnegie Hall, we're delighted to draw attention to this Luxman Ireland House initiative as part of this programming. Kevin, thanks for coming on the show. You have something to tell me.
Oh, just to add that there are many, many stories about the Scots-Irish mm-hmm. one could tell. From the 18th century or the 19th century. This is just one of them, and I tell it because I happen to have written a book on it. But there are so many other stories one could tell about religion, about politics, about the American Revolution. It's a rich and understudied aspect of the larger story of the American Irish, but one I think that is getting more and more attention as part of that field, and one that is very well known to those who study that history in particular.
Yeah, and it's always great to, you know, I say that in this and other contexts, that the 19th century is great and very rich, of course, for the Irish experience, but anything that adds complexity to our understanding to that early chronology and the breadth of what Irishness meant is really welcome. So thanks again, Kevin, and maybe another time soon we'll have a chat about other things, mm-hmm. in terms of your arrival to us here at Luxman Ireland House, and thanks again for taking the time out.
Thank you very much, Miriam. And